Welcome to Bounce Back. My name's Yvonne Fletcher from NY Events, and you're listening in on DRN1. Bounce Back is a fun talk back show where I get to interview some of the world's most funniest people. Today, joining me all the way from Colorado in the USA is comedian, rapper, and internationally amazing man, Chris Turner. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you, Yvonne. And the title, International Amazing Man, is lovely. Really nice.
I thought I'd twist it a little bit. We'll get into what you do a little bit more.
No, I'm just internationally amazing. Not locally, nationally, internationally.
We've gone abroad today. So we're basically, I'm in Perth.
You're in the future. How is it? Yeah. How's the 18th of February going?
Well, we're COVID-free here again. So that's great.
Absolutely fantastic. Very jealous.
When you get to this time, I wonder, are you guys COVID-free there or no? Is it still?
I don't think America has ever been COVID-free since February. The town that I'm staying in Colorado, is very lightly COVID-y.
Okay.
They're dealing with it quite well. I think there's a county of 18,000 people, and they've vaccinated 5,000 people with the first dose, which is impressive. A testament to the local health services, if not the federal.
So, Chris, talking about COVID, how have you coped during that time? Because travel's been off. You didn't get to Fringe World in Perth, which is where I first...
I missed that a lot. I've been reasonably fortunate. I'm married, and my wife and I have a very good relationship. So we're not a couple who've ended up divorcing so far. I don't have any kids to look after, so I have extended family members who are a bit older than me with kids, and it looks like the most stressful time for anyone with children. I've been very lucky with shows because, one, I was already doing a lot of virtual events anyway, live streaming shows just in general.
Yeah.
And two, I think what I do is quite interactive as far as comedy goes. And I really think it's just luck as to whether, you've done well with gigs during lockdown. There's so many great comedians who are brilliant, but maybe it hasn't translated as well over a virtual format. I'm fortunate that mine have. So I've been fine in that sense, but it's not the same, obviously. And I think, although I have a robust mental health at most times, I think, it's still been a tough year. I miss performing. That first month of no shows was so hard because you're used to getting up, maybe five nights a week. That makes me sound much more busy and into comedy than I probably am. I want to be on stage like three, four nights a week and have a normal life balance for the rest of it, unless it's like a tour period. But in just normal day-to-day life, three nights a week, maybe you're doing two shows a night. That's lovely. But you're used to this adrenaline. You're used to the feeling of people clapping.
Yeah.
And that's a lovely feeling, right? I think that a big reason people like performing is that the audience giving you that feedback. And so it's kind of like going cold turkey when you just stop doing shows. And one of the reasons that I didn't do any of the shows that popped up kind of in the middle of 2020, where people thought, oh, this is receding a bit. Let's do some parking lot shows. Let's do some rooftop shows in America or in the UK. I feared that withdrawal again, and not to, compare it to anything more kind of hardcore than it is, because, withdrawal symptoms from drugs and alcohol are obviously horrendous, but the withdrawal symptom from comedy was affecting. I did have a really unhappy month, and I couldn't figure out why until I realized, oh, I'm not getting this feedback I'm used to, or these kind of, the drugs that your brain produces. So I didn't go back on stage in like June or July when there were the options to, because I thought, well, what if there's an immediate lockdown again and I've got back on the stage and then I have to get off it again and go through this again. So I didn't do that. And I find that virtual shows, as fun as they can be, and I have done some really fun ones and some surprisingly entertaining ones, they don't give you the same reaction, because, that kind of bitty clapping on Zoom that you'll hear, that's not the same as the actual pressure of people in a room.
Yeah.
And I talk about this in shows. There's no risk to a Zoom show. If someone heckles you, you can kick them out. You can turn off your webcam, you can close the laptop and walk away, and what are they going to do?
Yeah.
And so I've missed shows tremendously. I feel, again, very fortunate that my wife and I were able to move to a larger place. I think that's been a really hard mm-hmm. thing for so many people staying in, you know, we're in a one bedroom apartment usually. And
yeah.
she does tutoring. So she was doing virtual tutoring. I was doing virtual shows. It kind of, you know, there's no doors to close in that apartment. There's no separate rooms. It's like a big room and then the other stuff. So we came in June, which especially was when COVID was getting really bad in LA. We came in June to Colorado to stay at her parents. And that's been a godsend to be able mm-hmm. to just have a house to run about in. My cat is much happier here, I think.
Yeah.
Not that he was ever used to going outside, but this town is dealing with it really well. This, you know, we're in the middle of nowhere. It's beautiful. It's snowy. And I think on a creative side, I've still been able to produce not the same content I was producing before. So I would, you know, film my live gigs and then put mm-hmm. that footage online every week because the show would always change. And that was great. And people loved that. And I'm very grateful for that. But obviously, as lockdown starts, there's no live show. So I've had to kind of experiment with written music and written raps or, you know, longer form content where I'm kind of talking through the stuff that I do. And I'm still trying to work out what to do with all that. And I have formats up my sleeve that I want to work on. And so that's been good. I feel it's good to have kept creative in a different way to how I usually would have, and in a way I doubt I would have had the pandemic not happened. However, obviously it would be better for the pandemic not to have happened for me to have stayed in my own creative furrow, just plowing along.
One of my questions is actually about what is your creative process? And obviously through this COVID journey, it's changed. So I guess, have you found a middle ground where you're happy sitting with that? And what do you do to get creative?
So to let people in on just what I do, I am a stand-up comedian, but also a freestyle rapper is one of the things I think I'm most known for, to the extent that I am known in any way. You know, I did a virtual Zoom show where they pretended I was a new hire. And I said, how many people are going to be on that call? And they said, 250. And I thought, I reckon 1% of people on that call will know who I am. I don't, you know, just the demographic was they were software engineers. I thought there's going to be some nerds, they're going to like me. And so I came on and they introduced me as my wife's surname, which is technically my surname because I took hers. They introduced me as Chris Wynn. And in the chat immediately, two people said, that's Chris Turner.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I thought, that's spot on because you can't get half. Some people might say, oh, you should round up. But no, I was spot on. Afterwards, the person who booked me said, she's like, I could have wrung their necks. They gave the game away. I'm like, no, no one looks at the chat. So I freestyle rap. And I, you know, my latest tour, the tour I was in Perth with in 2020, was a musical comedy show with freestyle rap, but also with written musical pieces in. So I think I approach writing my shows, such as stand-up, and my songs a similar way.
Yeah.
I've always used Perth, actually, and it was my fifth time there in 2020. I think my first time was maybe the second Fringe World that ran, or at least the third. Thomas Ford very kindly brought me over and produced me and, you know,
Thomas
let me stay at his house.
I love him. Yeah. He's
no,
so much fun.
So Perth is so lucky to have someone who puts that much. Obviously, there's so many great people there, but Thomas, you know, someone I had experience with, was incredibly valuable. And I would go to the Tuck Shop Cafe in Northbridge, and I would take my notes app on my phone. And throughout the previous 12 months, I'd amassed a lot of different material. And when I first started doing hour-long shows, I wasn't regularly doing new material nights. I was doing, you know, because I was still in kind of up-and-coming, trying to establish myself comedian in the UK. So you want to do your best material every show so they book you for a higher spot next time. So I wasn't able to try out all this new material. So what I did was go to Perth and not the first time I went, I had a show then, but the second time I wrote a show while I was there. and I'd try out material every night. And I used to do Rosie O'Grady's. I used to do the small room upstairs for like 50 people, do 5 dates, and then do the large room downstairs for 5 dates once the show had kind of bedded in. And I did that not this Fringe Gone, but the one before, because I brought my show Rap God, which I'd been working on for a year. I'd done a residency in New York. I'd done some shows in Orlando with it. And I knew it was in a space that I enjoyed. So I had that show written, but I still worked on it while I was there. But then I had a new show called Target Demographic, which I just wrote there in that same way, because it had been 2 years away from Perth at that point. Maybe I hadn't been for the two previous festivals because of green card issues. I couldn't leave America. There's no way I wouldn't have come to Perth if I'd been able to. And I sit down in the cafe and I look at a note, and I'm trying to think if I find an example of, and I always have like a phrase that I would just write down, which means I can then search through the notes. So I'd type target demographic, and that means every joke idea I'd thought of that year, I would put the phrase on, which might be the show title. It might not be. For this one, it did, because it was just a random title I came up with.
So that's sort of like your filing system as well.
Wow. So I'm trying to think like a joke that I didn't. I mean, this isn't even a joke that made it to the show, because I don't think it's good, but like it was something that, and this is not, you know, I'm prefacing, this is not funny. I don't come up with a funny idea. I come up with an idea, and then in a few months, if it's still funny, then, oh, maybe it'll be good on stage. This was something, you know, I wrote down and then it had no legs. I just wrote that Murakami, the Japanese writer, didn't become a writer until his 40s. And then the funny idea I had was, so that's 10 more years until I have to feel bad about not being a successful writer. Right? Like, and you just flip that concept of, oh, you know, you can do it then. No, the joke is no one's going to do it. But at least it's 10 more years till we have to feel bad. So that joke never even made it in. It should have. But I write down all on this piece of paper, and then I go on stage with the paper read jokes off them.
Yeah.
Target demographic, I don't know if I did that. I think I actually memorized it for that. And that show was my 6th one-hour show that I'd written, maybe even 7th. And so I'd kind of gotten to I know what material's funny now. I know it's rare I'll take a bit on stage and it'll bomb. There's always bits where they don't get the laugh you want. And there's bits that I'll do in Australia. And then I went back to LA. I put a video on YouTube today, which was the wrap of a set I'd done 2 days after landing back in LA last year. So February the 20th, I'd flown back on the 18th. And I'm very clearly jet lagged. The rap in that set is so many flubs with words. I don't pronounce things. I say Harry Potter's Wong. I call the movie Moonright rather than Moonlight. You get the gist of the rap, though. Yeah. It still makes sense. But I remember opening up that set because this routine I'd been doing in Australia, I really enjoyed. And I opened up that set with it and it just did fine.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, okay, this show, either this joke goes better with Australians or it worked better because people were coming to see my show. So they were like, oh, Chris walks on, opens with that joke. People are like, yeah, we know he's funny, so we'll trust him. Whereas they're going on stage and opening with essentially new material that had only been performed 7 or 8 times, that I think the crowd felt a bit more nervous. They were like, oh, yeah, kind of funny. Whereas in my solo show, I was like, this is a real fun bit of material.
Yeah.
Have you found
the crowds worldwide are very different, and do you have to change your material to suit them?
There's certain material you have to change, right? When I went to Australia the first time, I just asked people, hey, do you have these reference points? And then you switch the ones that aren't in there, or you drop material that won't ever translate. There's routines I do in America about American football that I did in Edinburgh, in an Edinburgh show, and it just always was a bit flatter. But I still did it because I thought it was an important bit of material. It was about CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or whatever it is, the brain diseases that you get from all the concussions. I thought it was an important bit of material to perform, even though it didn't hit as hard, pun not intended, because they didn't have the connection with it. But I felt like it was an education.
Yeah.
I think certain wordplay, certain puns don't translate as well in certain countries. But, you know, I've done my kind of weird, nerdy, intellectual jokes in England, and then I've done a show in Norway or Holland, and they've done really well. Like they like that, and I find that especially Norwegian audiences applaud rather than laugh. And I'm not a comedian who does that clapter thing, right? I don't talk about actual stuff. I don't really talk about politics. I don't talk about happenings. So it's not like I go, "Hey guys, oh, we need to impeach the president," and everyone claps rather than laughs. I just mean that these Norwegians would clap. And I figured out, my theory was, they were applauding to show that they understood the joke, and therefore they were very smart. And then other people would clap like, "Yes, I also understood that joke." I thought that was always fun. American audiences are really great because they're very enthusiastic, I think. I think the biggest difference I've noticed, and I think British and Australian audiences fall into the same basket here, but differently when it comes to an international act. So when I go to Australia, I found that audiences thought, "Oh, mate, he must be bloody good because he's flying all this way. How can he come out here if he's shit ass?" And so you'd have that advantage of being an international act, right?
Yeah.
Whereas in the UK, we get that with American acts or Australian acts. The audience would be like, "Oh, he must be pretty good. Otherwise, why is he here?" Whereas with a local act or just, you know, a British act, the audience, I think, go, "Oh, he thinks he's funny, does he? Well, let's see about that." And that's most pronounced in Liverpool. Many comedians say is their least favorite place to gig. I really like gigging in Liverpool because I think the audiences are as close as you get to American audiences, in that if they like you, they really like you.
Yeah.
The other way, I don't think American audiences go. I think American audiences are still generous, but a Scouse audience, a Liverpudlian audience, you have to catch them really early on. You have to impress them because people in Liverpool are very proud that they have a sense of humor. So they all think they're funny. So if you walk on and your first joke isn't good, they start thinking, I'm better than him. Why is he up there? So I used to walk on, hit him with like a couple of quick jokes up top, and then they'd trust you. And then they'd really get on board. American audiences, they're optimistic. They think, "Oh boy, I hope this guy's great. I want to have a great time. I hope this guy makes me laugh. I bet he does because he's on the stage." So they're already ready to laugh, whereas a British audience, you have to convince them that you are worth laughing at, which is flipped around when they're coming to your show, right? You come and see a Chris Turner show, you bought your ticket, you're invested. Just a weekend comedy show where you're on and they don't know who you are. And, you know, there's so many weird little variables in comedy clubs. Like, I mean, just to parallel British and American comedy clubs with this, I did a show in London where the opening act was Jack Whitehall. For anyone who doesn't know Jack Whitehall, very popular, successful comedian in the UK. He walks on stage and everyone goes crazy. They're like, "Oh, we know this guy.
Yeah.
Can't wait." And he's only the opening act. I can't imagine who's headlining this show. Now, I was the guy closing the show rather than headlining. I was just on last and Jack was there because he had to go do another show. So I walk on and everyone's just like, "Oh, who's this guy?" And it happens in America. Like when I play New York at the Comedy Cellar, which is, you know, arguably the best comedy club in the world, maybe, you know, at least the most famous. When you think of a New York comedy club, you think of an American comedy club, you think of a brick wall, smoke. Not that they have that anymore, but like small room, very closely packed. Maybe not anymore. But that's the club where Dave Chappelle will drop in and start doing a set. That's the show where you can see all these huge comedians. And so it's challenging to play there because the booker who has been booking it for, you know, a fair while, she knows comedy. She knows how to program a show. The MCs at those shows always give the perfect amount of energy. The opening acts always grab people and convince them it's going to be a good night. And so she schedules me at the end of shows. If I'm playing there, she'll put me on last because it has an energy, a big finish. It's something that the audience hasn't seen before. So it's a British guy freestyle rapping. That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And in the main room there, they have a two-piece band. So you've got a drummer and a keyboardist so that I can rap along to live music. And by virtue of having to go on at the end, it means I have to follow really good comedians. Because if you're near the end of the show, you're a big name.
Yeah.
So you're following Michelle Wolf, who's just destroyed with this like 15-minute bit. You're following Dave Attell, who's one of like the most battle road hardened comedians in America. You're following Sam Morrell. You're following all these incredible people, and you walk on and the audience just look at you and they're just like, why? Because they've heard of all the other people that are on and they stare at you. And my standard opener there is, I know, I also wish I was a famous comedian. And it's a really nice way to dispel that. And as soon as you do that, they go, oh, cool. Because that's like one of the simplest things in comedy is say what the audience is thinking and you get a laugh. And this works with everything. It works with jokes. It's a diffusing technique for when you bomb. If you tell a joke that sucks, if you just carry on like nothing happened, the audience start thinking, is he unfunny and oblivious? Whereas if you do a joke that sucks and you just look at them and go, ooh, that joke stank, people laugh. People will even applaud.
Yeah.
I was given advice, if you're bombing, just say, hey, I know this hasn't gone that great so far. Tell you what, do you mind if we, like, I've got a few minutes left, but like, do you find if we just restart? You walk off stage, come back on, get a round of applause and start the gig again. Not doing the full, you know, set length, but just finish off with that. You know, walk back on and go, whoa, that guy sucked. The audience are going to love that. That's a great tip to new comedians, by the way. You can use that.
Oh, thanks, Chris.
So, yeah, you just kind of say what the audience are thinking. The rap I put up today, I was watching it back, and there's a bit where I'm waxing lyrical about Harry Potter and naming all these facts. And I, in the rap, just to rhyme, say something about like, oh, I never thought I'd have this much knowledge. That's not cool. And the audience laugh because they've been thinking, wow, this guy's a Harry Potter nerd. What a loser. And so when you say, that's not cool, they all go, ha, 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 ha. Yeah. Say what the audience is thinking as an opener is always really good. Like in America, I'll walk on and just be like, hello, I'm not from your country. Sorry. walk on, just be like, good evening. God save the Queen. Say whatever they expect of you. Yeah. Comment on your appearance. In America, weirdly, and this is another thing that's different with audiences, they don't like too much self-deprecating humor. Especially if you're presenting yourself not as a low status individual. So there are characters and there are performers who have very low status on stage where they're always kind of like hangdog, they're beaten down, the world's getting them down. Rodney Dangerfield is like a big example. You know, all his jokes are kind of punching it. If he said them with a high status persona, he'd be punching down because he's making jokes about his wife and all these, you know, things. But because he's such a horrid little man, all his jokes end up punching up because like, wow, you're the most loathsome individual. You are. We pity you. It's always punching up. Whereas if you are a higher status person, which, you know, I don't say I don't deliberate high status, but you know, I'm a 6'2" privately educated white man. Like, yeah. I think I give it off by virtue of that privilege. So I walk on and I'll do a self-deprecating joke. I'll, you know, just do a joke about like not having a chin or whatever it is. But then if I do more than that, if I do two or three self-deprecating jokes, the audience start going, oh, is he okay? And I remember really early on doing a joke saying, oh, it's real nice to be here with you. This is a really intimate show. I like this. I like that, you know, we're a small group in 5-6 years when I'm really famous, you can tell all your friends that you did not expect that. And that's the joke, right? Someone just goes, hey, buddy, I think you're great. And you're like, no, it's a joke. Like, come on, guys. I also want to drop in a joke that's not mine, but my kind of writing partner when I was at university, we wrote sketch shows and he had a great joke. His name's Phil Brown, doesn't perform anymore, but he said, I love doing self-deprecating comedy. I'm just not very good at it. That's a really fun joke. He also had a great joke about, I used to feel very ostracized, but then I measured an ostrich and realized my mistake. Real dumb jokes.
Oh, they're funny. Chris, how did you actually get started in comedy and then rapping? Were they separate? Did they merge or did you do both at the same time?
So they were separate and then merged after a long time. I started rapping when I was 12.
Oh, and God.
I won't expand too much on that because I talk about it in my shows a lot anyway. I started rapping when I was 12 because I heard Eminem's Marshall Mathers LP. Yeah. I heard Dr. Dre's 2001, and I thought, these are so cool. They're also rude. They swear. I thought that was really exciting. And so I just rapped along to them and just really liked it. And then my dad bought Outkast's Danconia album because he liked the Miss Jackson song. And I'm listening to it going like, these are crazy. Who even is this? Like, what? And it just blew my mind. So I listened to all that and started rapping. And then my comedy started when I'd always performed. I'd always done acting summer schools and little school assemblies and sketches and things like that. And that was partially my dad getting me into comedy and playing me tapes or records or CDs of comedians that he liked. And I'd seen some stand-up. I think the first stand-up specials I watched solely as stand-up specials was Jimmy Carr's first special and Ricky Gervais's first special, which was Animals, which I think is a really great stand-up special. And I knew all the words to those, but I had no intention of being a comedian. I didn't know it was a job you could do.
Yeah.
So I went to university and I saw an improv group called the Oxford Imps. And I thought they were really funny, really, really funny. And I thought, I could do that. And that's not like I could do that. It was like I want to do what they're doing. Yeah. That looks great.
That's cool.
So I auditioned and got in. And I thought, that's cool. And then they're like, hey, guys, 100 people auditioned and only 6 of you got in. So well done. And I thought, oh, I guess I must be pretty funny. So started doing improv, really enjoyed it, but was a bad improviser in the sense that I was very selfish. I wanted to get the laughs. I didn't want to set my scene partner up for the laughs. And that's bad improv, right? So I thought, I'll do some stand-up. And this was July 2009. July 2009, I think.
Yeah.
It was my first gig. It was like 5 days after Michael Jackson died. So we can date it from then.
Yeah.
And I wrote a little set. My first joke that I ever did was I walked on stage and everyone had done Michael Jackson jokes and I knew they would have because it's an open mic, right? And I'd seen some open mic gigs, so I knew everyone just does shock jokes. So I walked on and I stand there at the microphone looking really weird with my hands in my pockets. And I say, hey guys, I know everyone's doing Michael Jackson jokes, but I grew up loving Michael Jackson. I'm like a huge Michael Jackson fan, which is true. And so I respect him too much to dishonor his memory with cheap gags. And then I take the microphone at the stand, and as I take my hand out my pocket, I'm wearing one white glove. That's the joke.
Yeah.
And it was fun. It was a fine first set as far as things go, enough to make me want to do it. And I did it again 2 months later, at the Edinburgh, maybe a month later at the Edinburgh Festival. And then I did it 2-3 months after that at a nightclub in Oxford where I did 5 minutes at a proper comedy club and I got silenced off stage. First 2.5 minutes were fine. Then I did a joke that they just didn't like. And then it was awful. And I think what you need to be a comedian is this kind of unflappable confidence that you are funny, because in my notebook where I was rating all my gigs at that time, yeah, I gave that gig a 6 out of 10. And I think my point was like, well, they were just a stupid crowd. So, and now I definitely think it's at the point where I've been a comedian for a long time, at least, it feels like it. And I do it as a job. So sometimes if you do a gig that doesn't go that well, you think, nah, that wasn't me. These jokes are good. You guys are bad. If you do new material, that's fine. So when the rap crossed over with the stand-up was in my improv, I was doing, it was a short form improv show, so Whose Line Is It Anyway, quick fire games and stuff. But the games that I really excelled at least in comparison to the other games that I was doing, were the musical games, specifically the rap games. There was a game called Bust a Line or Bust a Rhyme. It was a pun on Bust a Rhymes, but the idea was you did a scene and then whenever the keyboardist starts beatboxing, you had to rap. So you'd be talking Hey, what a lovely day to be here at the beach. And then someone's going boom, ba-ch, boom, boom. And suddenly you have to start rapping about shells. And I really loved that game. And I had a couple of the improvisers said, hey, that's good. You're good at that. And I didn't realize there was anything special about it. I thought that, you know, oh, well, you know, it's just freestyle. And, it's, you know, it's just a like a silly game that you do. And then maybe 3 years into my stand-up career, now looking back at it, obviously at the time, hobby, experiment, risk, I started doing a stand-up show at the Edinburgh Festival called AAA Batteries Not Included, where it was a kids' comedy show. Oh, wow. It was a free comedy show, but I figured that, you know, parents will give you money if they enjoy it, as well as just, oh, I'll buy tickets for the kids. So we aimed the comedy at the parents. We were trying to entertain them.
Yeah.
And just make sure the material was suitable for the kids. And I would host or perform. We kind of mixed it around. And this show still runs. Like, I still program it. You know, I rarely host it because if I'm in Edinburgh, I'm just quite busy with shows. But I'm really proud of that show. It's had, you know, performers on who are just incredible. And I now at the end do a rap. But back then, I just every couple of shows, I'd interact with the kids. And if they had like a dinosaur toy, I'd say, hey, can I get that on stage? And I'd get the toy up. And then I'd make a joke about, he's a rapping dinosaur from the Jurassic 5, which like a few dads would laugh at. And then I'd just do a little rap from the dinosaur. I'd be like, what do you want to hear a rap about? And they're like, race car. And then it's like this dinosaur rapping about race cars. And one of the comedians was dating a comedy critic, and she came to see the show and just said to me, or even told the comedian who then told me, hey, what Chris did was pretty cool. He should do that in his act normally, which obviously is, you know, them saying, oh, your act's usually absolutely awful. This would make it somewhat better. So I started doing it because I just thought it was a gimmick. I thought, why would you want to see freestyle rap on a comedy stage? It didn't make sense to me. Like, you come in here to see comedy. And I don't think I particularly liked musical comedy at the time. I was very much a purist. I was like, you should do jokes. And obviously that wasn't getting me anywhere. So I started doing it in my open spots, right? Which is where they're trying you out at clubs. The club says, hey, go on, do 10 minutes. We'll see if you're any good. We might book you more if you are. And so I'd do 5 minutes of jokes and then end with a rap. And it in the same way that the comedy seller puts me on at the end, these clubs started going, oh, well, we can't have him. You can't do that before the headliner. Makes it harder for the headliner. Now, obviously, there's plenty of great comedians who can handle that, whatever. And I actually don't think it was ever a problem. But club bookers may have got feedback from audiences being like, oh, wow, that was great. Get him on. So they started putting me on to open. But then that also didn't really work because, it set the bar like, whoa, this is crazy. What a great high-energy thing. And then the rest of the show was a stand-up show.
Yeah.
This isn't to overstate like me thinking I was great. This is just like, it's what happened at a few clubs, not all of them, but enough that I ended up headlining shows way before I was ready. Like weekend comedy clubs where they're all boozed up and I walk on at the end and they all go, who are you? Why are you on stage? And then I'd do a rap and they'd go, what? This guy's incredible. Sometimes. Other times they're just like, yeah, whatever. But that's how I started doing it. And, you know, I'm still developing my act. I'm still, you know, I am a comedian who does freestyle raps. I'm not a freestyle rapper who wants to do stand-up comedy as well. My freestyle is, you know, I am at a higher level in my freestyle than I am in my comedy because I've been freestyling for 13 years. Yeah. Whereas I've been doing, no, not 13, 19 years, sorry.
19, wow.
Whereas comedy for 12 years. And so, yeah, it's a big difference. Mm. It's a real big difference, I think. And my shows now, I am become what I am hate, the musical comedian. I now do musical comedy because I realized, oh, I actually do like musical comedy. I love Bo Burnham. I love Flight of the Conchords. I love Bill Bailey. Yeah. And Bill's performing, but the others aren't really. There's not really much musical comedy going around. And there's not the musical comedy I liked, which was, hey, you got to listen carefully because this is just a lot of jokes. Mm. And that's the stuff that I'm working on. That's my shows now. It's like every line's a joke. And the guys that I've teamed up with over lockdown, a record label called 800 Pound Gorilla, who are a comedy record label in America, they rarely release musical comedy. And I asked, I sent them some stuff and they had a meeting and they said, look, musical comedy is just really lazy a lot of the time. It's, you know, one joke to a chorus. Yeah. And they're like, what we like about yours is it's a funny idea, the song's catchy, and then every line is a joke. And I thought, well, yeah, why wouldn't you make every line funny? And so that's what I've been trying to do is, and increasingly I'm trying to make good music. I'm trying to make catchy songs. I think the last three songs I put out have been really fun because they get stuck in your head. Like my mother-in-law will come to me and she go, hey, I don't like that song about foreskins that you did, but I am singing it. And that's good, right? If you can have a chorus, you know, I did a French one. And that's kind of how I write the songs. It's not sitting down with all these ideas and trying to eke them out. It's coming up with an idea that I can build a song around. So I did the song about foreskins because for some reason I thought that was a funny idea. And then during the process of making that video, I was downloading a lot of stock footage to use in the video because you have to be creative, right? I can't shoot every video in the snow outside or in the barn outside. I have a green screen. And so I was cutting it with all the stock footage and I realized, oh, I've got, you know, 20 gigabytes of stock footage, most of which is bottoms. And I didn't use those in the foreskin video. And that's my excuse for why there's lots of nudity on my laptop. So I thought, okay, I'll do a song about bottoms. What's the funniest way to do that? A Frenchman singing a sexy song about bottoms? Yeah, cool. What would be a catchy chorus? J'adore la derrière. And then that was it. And then the chorus is J'adore la derrière, Zemmour, Zemmerrière, as a general arrière, you know, all that stuff. While doing that one, I was like, okay, well, I've done two sexy songs about foreskins, which are so sexy, and derrières. I'll do a third one. I'll do a Valentine's Day one. And that took me 2 days to come up with an idea because you want to be original. And so many songs are about love. And so many songs are, you know, Tenacious D have so many songs about Flight of the Conchords. So many love songs like, ooh, Business Time. So you're like, what's an original song you can do? So it took me a while to come up with that. And so I did a song about, you know, a guy who only dates very, very, very old women. And why would that be? Where are the jokes there? And so every line has to be a joke, you know. And also the fun thing with that was keeping it respectful. I didn't want the joke to be, sex with old people. What? I wanted it to be, no, the jokes are going to be the jokes. So the jokes are, you know, I want to jump her bones like osteoporosis. She's had a double hip replacement. She says, let's wear these ones out too. It's she's 99, so we her age minus 30. You've got to think every line has to be catchy, rhyme, and a joke. And so it's technically, I realized what I didn't like as a young performer was lazy musical comedy. Whereas now I'm like, oh, musical comedy is hard because every line's a joke. Each song has, you know, 64 little jokes in. That's mad. That's so many jokes. That's a 20-minute set and you're doing it in 3 minutes. And that's been really fun to pack that density in. It makes me feel like a real show-off. The limits are I cannot sing. So that Valentine's Day song, my producer, I said like, hey, can you make me sound not bad at singing? He's like, yeah, I think so. So that's cool. But then I'm going to have to perform it live at some point because I like the song. And so I'm going to have to learn how to at least hold a tune, even if I get him to like prepare the backing vocals so it does sound like there's a chorus being like, yeah, she's wrinkly. And I'll be there on stage just monotoning.
I know an amazing voice coach who does Zoom help. So if you want her details later, I'll pass them on. She worked for Whopper and does Wonderful. Opera and all sorts. So,
oh my gosh. Yeah. I had singing lessons for about a year and a half and it didn't really help. All I could end up coming away from was a passable Fly Me to the Moon. And that's disappeared from my range. Yeah. What the thing my voice, I like my voice. I can do fun, like I really like rapping in a low voice. And go very low.
And they can go very high as well. So it's fun to do that when you're talking.
In my kids' show, I used to do a joke where I'd pretend I had a helium balloon.
Yeah.
So I'd like inhale it and be like,
do you guys like helium balloons? You like the way it makes your voice sound, yeah. Hey, any dads want to do it? Can you do it?
And then you'd hand them the balloon and they'd inhale and then they'd talk in their normal voice. And you'd be like, ah, your dad sucks. And all the kids are like, ha ha, dad sucks. He can't do it. Yeah. Now we can't do that. Can't share balloons in this COVID age.
You can't share the air, right?
Yeah.
Hey, Chris, I wanted to ask you a question, actually. So I'm with NY Events. We've taken on a heat of class clowns. Have you heard of class clowns before? If you haven't, it's
that's,
right.
Yeah. Oh, that's to do with the
Melbourne Comedy Festival.
Yeah. They have the talent search. Yeah. I mean, I know comedians who've come through that who are very, very funny.
Absolutely.
Not class clowns, but whatever the one above it is. And then class clowns
Raw.
Is the, you know,
Raw is the one above.
Through Raw. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're doing class clowns this year and it's coming up on the 17th of March. It's generally for 14 to 18 year olds, but because of your previous experience as, you know, a child growing up in this and then also during kids events, do you have any advice for anyone that's coming into the competition? They've got to do a 5-minute set and basically it will be recorded and then they've got the opportunity to go to Melbourne, should Melbourne be COVID free, and perform at the Melbourne Comedy Festival.
What advice would I give? I'm trying to think the advice I'd give to myself. I mean, one thing I did when I was a new comic, and, you know, I was 19 when I was doing my first set, so a bit older, but not too much. I kind of identified my weakness, which was my delivery. I sucked at delivering jokes, but my jokes were good. So I deliberately adopted a style, super deadpan, where I just tell the joke. So I would, now I'd tell the joke in a casual way, but back then I'd come on stage and just go, I bought a laminator. It's a machine that kills baby sheep. And that, you know, that works. Whereas now you toss that off as like, oh, because I bought this laminator. It's a machine that kills baby sheep. And I think the joke, you know, the joke hits hard in the deadpan for a 5-minute set. After 15 minutes grows tedious. It's you can't sit through that unless it's a genius like Stephen Wright. So when you're that young and that new, when you're that fresh, right? And this is, you know, maybe they're already incredibly adept, especially with the consumption of comedy. The more comedy you watch, the better you're going to get at it. But you're not the finished package, right? You're still working on bits of it. So what are you good at? In 5 minutes, you can do that for most of the thing. If you have an incredible delivery, lean on that. If you're great at act outs, you can have a 5-minute set with mostly act outs. If you suck at voices, don't do any voices in your set. If you're a bad joke writer, amp up your performance. So I'd say that's an important thing. Also, the best comedians, the comedians that I think succeed really well, and I don't count myself as being, as having this certain thing, it takes a long time to figure out your voice. But what people say by voice is they mean point of view, approach to things. And I think, as I presume they're performing for an audience of adults, they have the kind of luxury of everyone in the audience, if they choose to address these things, having gone through most of what they might talk about, right? If you're a teenager and you're doing material about your parents, the people watching will either have been a teenager or be parents or both. So you have an audience that's going to relate a lot to whatever you're saying. Or maybe you've had an upbringing, or maybe you have a perspective on life that's totally different to everyone else's, and therefore that's interesting. I've seen comedians where they've walked on and they've said, you know, hey, I'm from Bosnia and I grew up in a circus. And then they do a punchline and you're like, that's a good joke. Cool. I can't wait to hear your set about being Bosnian growing up in a circus. And then the rest of their set is just stand-up comedy about, oh, I was on the train. Let me tell you about this crazy thing. I'm like, no, but I want to hear about you and your story. Now, I don't particularly have that. When people say, what's your voice? I'm like, I don't know. I'm a nerdy white guy who raps. That's not a voice. That's what I do. Yeah. And I like it when someone has a unique perspective. And comedians that pop big early on often have that. Kevin Bridges is a great Scottish comedian, but he got huge when he was 20 and he'd been going 3 years, I think. And that's because he was a working class Scottish voice who told great jokes. And so all of his bits were about growing up in Glasgow, which anyone watching him in Glasgow would relate to that. Yes, we know what happens. We can laugh at the familiarity. Anyone outside laughs at, wait, what? You do what in Glasgow? I love Glasgow. It's an amazing place to perform. I should clarify that just because I do go there quite a bit. But, you know, it's surprising to learn of, like, you know, how often they talk about chibbing people, like a knife. So I would say, you know, what's the thing that you can talk about that no one else can? And that doesn't mean it's a story or it's an aspect of your life. You know, the thing that I could do that no one else could was tell these really weird niche jokes. No one else was doing that. And people liked that for, you know, when I was doing them. So, yeah, I think that's my advice.
Thank you, Chris.
Because all the other stuff comes with practice. You don't get good on stage till you've been on stage hundreds of times. Don't try and fake that. Don't try and pretend like you're some pro. You know, you're a young kid doing stand-up, so...
Yeah, I think a lot of it will be their first times. They've got a workshop that they attend prior to the actual performance, and then they get up and, yeah, compete. So,
yeah, but also, I mean, the advice there is, like, quite often you'll see, I've seen, like, comedy graduation classes. They've all done this comedy class, and then they all get on stage and all their sets are about different things but with the same joke structures. It's like in LA you see this a lot. Someone will say, hey, can you headline this graduation show? And you see people's sets and you see, oh, they have, like, these comedians have a something about them that's great, but all their opening jokes are, you know, hey, I grew up here and my dad does this, so punchline. And you think, if they're doing the workshop, obviously you need to learn joke structure, but also if you think something is funny and it lies outside that. I used to walk on stage with a tiny little cassette player sized synth that in it, just, it was like just a looper, and it had 13 different drones on it, and I would put it down in front of the microphone. I'd take the microphone out, put it in front of the microphone, so it would just be playing this weird sound through the speakers. And then I would shout at the audience. I'd just say, a wise man once said, and you'd immediately get a laugh. You'd already have people laughing because they're like, what is this guy doing? A wise man once said, feet are just shit hands. And people would laugh because, I mean, that's a fun, that was, I stole that joke from my friend because he was really stoned one night and he went, aren't feet just shit hands? And it was because we were, like, putting feet in his face or something. And he was like, no, mate, I don't like feet. Feet are just shit hands. So I used to do that, get a laugh. And then I'd get the microphone, just pick it up and do my set. But it got a good laugh, and it made people realize they were going to get something a bit weird, which they did, because I was doing deadpan one-liners, which was different. So if you are, like, that was a risk. And I would never blooming start a show like that now. I'm not brave enough. I don't take risks anymore. Singing for me on stage is a risk, right? You know, I play guitar. I would quite like to be able to play guitar in one of my shows or somewhere. That would be a risk. And you've got to keep injecting that to keep your creative juices flowing. But yeah, if you're a young act and you have an idea and you've never seen anyone do it on stage, or you've seen someone do something from a clip from the 70s and no one's done it since then do it. Do your unusual thing, because that is what makes your act yours. And that's so hard to have that when you're that new and that young, because really you're just an amalgamation of all your influences.
Yeah,
but so true. I do look back at some of the stuff I did when I was a new act before I thought of doing comedy as a career, and it was not bold, it wasn't daring, but it felt it. It felt weird to go on stage in orange trousers and do a joke about how the audience had missed a bargain in the closing down sale at Guantanamo. And that was daring because it means I had to wear orange trousers all night. So, do that. Don't be afraid to milk your originality.
Do you like that advice? Thank you so much. Random questions for you, and then I'll ask you if you're happy to finish on a joke or a rap light. That would be amazing. What's one of your pet peeves? Just in life.
I try, so there's a quote that I have on my phone wallpaper, which is, from Marcus Aurelius, the Stoic philosopher and Roman emperor. If you've seen Gladiator, he's the old emperor in that. And he said, and if my phone, there we go. Begin each day by telling yourself, today I shall be meeting with interference, ingratitude, insolence, disloyalty, ill will, and selfishness, all of them due to the offender's ignorance of what is good or evil. So what he's saying is, if you tell yourself that every bad thing that someone does is not because they are evil and not because they are out to get you, or not because they've not even considered you, the reason they've done it is because they didn't realize what they're doing is bad. And so this isn't to say I'm perfect, and this isn't to say that I take everything with this, but I do try and approach things in the sense that I try and ascribe good to whatever it is that someone's done. Now, obviously, you can take this to extremes and think I'm absolutely bonkers, which is not. I'm not saying that, you know, someone who punches an old woman is doing something good, you know. What I'm saying is, the world we live in is very frustrating. And again, I'm coming from a position of privilege. I'm able to say this because I have a very nice life, and I have, you know, very few things that affect me or are able to affect me as a straight white man. But if I'm in traffic and someone is beeping at me, or someone like cuts me off on the freeway, I always try and tell myself, like, oh, they must really need to get somewhere. They must have someone in the back giving birth. Otherwise, why would they drive like that? If someone is rude to me, if someone cuts in line, if someone pushes you out of the way on the sidewalk, then I'm like, wow, that person must be going through the worst day. They must have just had a call that like their best friend is dead. Mm-hmm. And I find that by doing that, it allows me to tap into this thing that Marcus Aurelius said. And again, I'm in a position with my mental health where I'm able to kind of, you know, think of this. I have a pretty firm grip on my brain and how it works. Like when I try and explain freestyle to people, it's about getting in the zone. It's about getting into flow. If you've seen the movie Soul, and if you haven't, you definitely should watch it. Anyone listening, it's so good. It depicts what flow is like. It's this place where nothing else matters. Everything is what you're doing. And I feel like I get into that when I'm rapping occasionally. Doesn't always happen. Definitely doesn't happen in live in virtual shows as much as live shows, because adrenaline, right? You need the adrenaline. But people ask, oh, do you meditate? And I've never meditated. Oh, I've tried it, but like I've never found need to, because I've always had this weird thing where people say, oh, clear your mind. And I just go, okay, cool, done. Yeah. And I'm like, oh no, meditation is someone, and for an hour they're trying to do that. And I weirdly can just go, boom, brain clear. So like, I'm not saying that I don't get sad or things don't affect me, but I definitely have like a very lucky in my brain chemistry that I can just kind of trick myself into thinking things. I can be like, yeah, I can believe that that person has had a death in the family and that's why they're behaving that way. That being said, pet peeves. Yeah, I mean, I dislike rudeness, right? But again, I try not to let it bother me. One thing I've always done, I used to work in a supermarket very late at night. I used to do night shifts in 24-hour supermarket. And by doing that, you're essentially doing one of the worst jobs, like one of the worst kind of standard jobs. It's a service job, but it's only with drunk people. It's only with scary people. And this is in like a part of Manchester that was a little bit kind of, you know, deprived in terms of funding, and, you know, the council didn't really care about it. So people there would be in pretty bad moods all the time. Mm-hmm. You had to deal with these people. And whenever someone came in and was nice to me, they said my name on my badge, or they like smiled and asked me how I was, it felt very important. It felt really, it would help you through those shifts. And so I've always tried to be so nice to anyone in service. Now, I'm sure if you've served me at a place and I was in a bad mood, maybe I wasn't as nice, but I really try and be nice to people. I try and compliment them. I try, like I always, in America, I tip more than you should. And that's partially because I have this fear that if I ever got famous, someone would do a story saying he was a bad tipper. So I'm always like, boom, it's purely self-image. It's self-fashioning, as my wife says. I when someone is rude to someone who is doing a hard job for no money, like I used to do telephone fundraising. And, you know, that was, people didn't mind that call because it was someone from their old school being like, hey, can we raise money for the bursary or the scholarship? But I always try and be nice to cold callers. I don't need to. But think of how many times a day that person is told to, like, go and kill themselves, right? Mm-hmm. So I always try to be like, I don't want to do that, but thank you so much for calling. I hope you have a lovely day. And so I do get very, very angry when people are rude to people working service jobs. However, I'm too much of a coward to do anything about it. Like, I wish I was like one of those Hollywood stars who goes, hey, mister, you're crowding this lady, or, you know, hey, don't speak to her like that. But
Chris,
in America especially,
maybe you will. Like, because
well, yeah, I just worry that in America, everyone has guns, so you have to be careful.
Yeah. okay, all right. You can do it in Perth. Practice there.
Yeah.
Chris, you are an absolutely beautiful, kind person, but I love that you brought up stoicism as well. It's a really good quality, but the fact that you can actually ground yourself and you're very present is great. Just the kindness from you is just, yeah, it oozes out. It's lovely.
It's strange for me because I wasn't a nice person when I was, you know, 19 or 20. I was very arrogant and I have to take responsibility for that, but also just, you know, I went to an all boys school where we were told we were exceptional, we were the best of the best, and then, you know, I got exam results that I was like, wow, I'm pretty great, everyone, I'm great. and it's strange to me, there's people who knew me at university who I've met since, and one of them literally just went, you're not a dick anymore. And I thought it was so fun. And they're like, people chat to my wife and like she's had meetings with people or she's met people and they've gone, wait, your husband's Chris Turner? And she's gone, yeah. And they're like, oh. And they can't fathom. They're like, why are you married to this dick? And it's like, no. When I was on the comedy circuit, when I was like 21, 22, I was an absolute terrible piece of poo. Horrible. Like, I thought I was so awesome. I was so big-headed and so just like, oh, yeah, I always destroy. Oh, I'm amazing. And what a horrible personality to have. What a horrible person to be around.
You were a child, you were still growing into your adult.
Well, of course, yeah, but there's still no excuse, really. You should have grown out of that. But, I mean, essentially, I think I remained a teenage boy for just quite a long time. And it was, I mean, I partially ascribe it, I mean, probably wholly ascribe it to her, just because, you know, I wanted to date her. And she was like, oh, no, I only, you know, was interested in you because you were like a bad boy. That makes him sound much cooler than I am. But she's like, no, she'd had a breakup. She's like, I just wanted to hook up with you because, I don't know, I thought you seemed like a dick and I'm not going to fall for you. And so I was like, okay, I guess I need to be a better person. So kind of became a nicer person. And that makes it, I think that makes it come across like it might not be genuine. It might be an act, which I used to worry that. And it's the thing I occasionally worry about. I'm like, oh, what if I've just tricked myself? And I think it's not. I think it's, I've grown up. And,
you can see that, yeah.
Yeah, and I do very much ascribe Perth to like a big part of this because I came to Perth and there are people I'm friends with still who I met then on like my first time in Perth. And I think if I had gone a year before, they would have been like, oh, who is this guy? We hate him. Whereas then they were like, oh, he's fun. And one thing that was interesting for me going to America was like, you have a way that people describe you. When you go off stage, people will be like, oh, I love your comedy. You're so quick. Yeah. So I used to get that. They go, oh, you're very quick. And then when I went to America, people would come up to me and be like, hey, can I get a photo? You're so nice. Which was puzzling for me, really, really puzzling, because it would never have been an adjective I'd describe myself with. And I remember doing a show called Put Your Hands Together, which was the first comedy podcast, first live stand-up comedy podcast, and it was a live show, that's what they recorded, and Cameron Esposito was the host, and Cameron was so like so funny, so quick. And I adored her. I adored that show. And I went on the show. They asked me to do the show. And when I'd finished my set, which went really well, it was like everything you could hope for to be on a show that you wanted to be on, a show that I was listening to before, you know, when I started doing stand-up. And she brings, you know, she back announces me. That was Chris Turner. Isn't he nice? And I thought, oh, that's nice.
That's beautiful, Chris.
Yeah. And it's very weird for me. And it doesn't chime with, again, I always find it weird. Like if I ever did get famous, there would be people who knew me growing up who'd be like, ugh, he's a real piece of shit. Like, that's all an act. And it's like, no. You can have been a person and then change it. You know, I know people who, when I knew them, were awful because of various reasons. And then you meet them again, and you're like, oh, you, whatever you had a problem with, and not that, you know, I think it was all just me. Like, what I had problems with was just myself. And I kind of was able to get past that and work on being a better person.
And we can change. That's the reality of
us. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, you have to want to, right? You have to want to. And I think, I probably had the privilege and fortune of being able to before I kind of end up getting blacklisted from every comedy club for just being a asshole. So, yeah, very grateful to my wife for doing that.
Oh, how did you guys meet?
So she was part of the same improv group that I was at Oxford, but she's younger than me. So I was performing at the Edinburgh Festival. The improv group said, hey, do you want to come and guest in a show? It was really early on in the run, so they were a few performers short. And she was on stage, and in the warm-up, I thought, oh, she's really pretty. She's really pretty. Yeah. And then on stage, she was so funny. And I remember doing a scene with her and just being like, oh, she's really good at improv. She makes me laugh. Like, it's hard to not laugh when she was doing stuff. So I think I had this thing that, this is very much a man thing, I think. I like a girl who's got a good sense of humor. And what they mean is, I like a girl who laughs at my jokes. And that's what I used to think. And then I was like, oh no, she makes me laugh. So that's great. I think she's the funniest person. We've done shows together. We do a podcast together. She makes me laugh a lot. She's so smart. She's so funny. And she's fit. So that was how we met. Yeah. And then it was, you know, that was August, but we didn't start going out until November 7th of that year because, she, you know, would not take me until then. Had to really do some, I mean, like turning up outside our house with flowers stuff.
Oh,
date me.
That's
we'll
gorgeous.
See.
Oh, so you wooed her. I love it. It's beautiful. Chris, we're about to finish. Can we, could you please share a joke or a rap? What would you like to do?
Yeah, we'll do a little rap.
That'd be amazing. Thank
let
you.
Me get some music up. And do you want to just give me 3 suggestions? We won't make it a long one.
Oh my goodness.
But like 3 topics, or, you know, they can be current events. They can be random stuff. Can be as imaginative as you want.
Oh, as imaginative or as boring as I like. Hey, what about?
Yeah, exactly. No, you can. They can be boring.
Well, what about Perth? Just been in a lockdown, so maybe coming out of a lockdown, or and maybe add Perth in there because you know I love Perth. I love where we are, and we do miss you here. We wish that you were here during Fringe World.
I wish I was there. I wish I was there as well. Yeah.
And then yeah, I don't know. We've just had Valentine's Day, so it's been a bit of love in there. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Is that okay? Like,
yeah. Valentine's Day and love coming out of lockdown. Let's get one more.
Oh, okay. Oh, gosh. Okay. Oh, what about, I don't know. Oh, gosh. Can you help me out here?
Well, it's your. I have to turn it into the rap. This isn't the hard bit.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's not. I know. Okay. What about
you said earlier you had a coffee fail, so what happened with your coffee?
Oh my gosh, I should show you the photo. I tried to make my own and the thing dropped out and coffee went everywhere and I ended up
Did you try to make it in a pour over?
No, one of those machines, you know, a proper coffee machine.
Okay, so you tried to make an espresso machine and it went from espresso machine it went wrong. Yeah. Okay,
I
so espresso disaster.
Yeah.
So the suggestions that we'll use: espresso disaster, coming out of lockdown, Perth, and Valentine's Day and love. Okay, can you hear this beat if I play it? Can you hear that?
Yes, I can hear that.
Great, cool. Well, I'll use this. So this is a freestyle about those things, all made up. Let's have some fun.
Okay.
It's a struggle when the push comes to shove. February 14th, I'll be shouting about love. If you're single, you can't mingle, spread the disease. But if you're at home in a couple, then please go ahead. You can take it right away. Roses paint red for the Valentine's Day. Don't be like Al Capone and do a massacre on the Valentine's Day. Yeah, you get the ass for sure if you're flattering your lady, flattering your lad. Unless your cooking is awful and bad, then you wish you had a little takeaway. Perth had a lockdown like 7 days, a whole week you were inside. Yeah, I know you hate to stay there struggling. You gotta get toilet paper off all of the aisles. The shelves, they're flying. People in this market panic buying. I almost said Walmart, it doesn't exist there. Northbridge, so quiet, you can hear crickets there. People walking around saying, where are the crowds? During the fringe world, nothing was allowed. Then they cut it right down. If you're present in the audience, 30%, all the shows you can saw it, seen it, get my participle correct. Encore extension for the season, what comes next? Let's go, like Mario Italian when you make an espresso. Maybe stick to getting it from the shop, because you seem to mess it up with the milk and the froth, and it makes all the slop on top of all the surfaces, all the pressure PSI it deserves to hit. It blasts out on the Carrera marble. I would say be careful, I'm partial to espresso. Maybe get a Longo Americano, these ones that are brung though, they're from the Starbucks. No, cause there ain't none around. I like to get my espresso finely ground, or maybe rough if you wanna have a laugh. Run the warm water through like a bubble bath into the carafe. I'm so glad you asked. I got it out long like the drink, like the neck of a giraffe. I mix it, I got a lot to say. I make it larger, elongated latte. That's a freestyle rap, impro flow. Finish off frothy like a cappuccino.
Woo! That was great, Chris.
Thank you, I thought so too.
That was fabulous. Chris Turner, I feel so honored that you joined me. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I would say it's been a lovely conversation, but it's really been a screed for me. I've just been monologuing. So thank you very much for letting me do that. I do appreciate it.
I love listening to people and hearing about their journey and stories. So thank you so much for sharing.
You've been listening to Bounce Back. My name's Yvonne Fletch, and today we've had comedian rapper Chris Turner. Remember to subscribe on your favorite podcast app and join me next week. Bye.